Thank you very much, Anna, for putting this great conference together. And yes, I'm talking about minimalism. So you get just bread and water, nothing else. You get more for dinner. You had lunch, you had coffee, so you can just do with bread and water. Wouldn't like to put forward a proposal for fundamental ontology, which is defined just by two axioms. There are distance relations, and these relations individuate simple objects, and let's call these objects megapoints. These objects are permanent, and the distances, they change. Okay? That's it. And what I will do in the next 45 minutes is try to make a bit of publicity for this proposal. So, spell out a bit of metaphysics, do a little bit of physics, but I mean, there won't be the time to deploy everything. Well, we'll see. So, the idea is that these two axioms are minimally sufficient for ontology of the natural world. That means certain further standards that should be coherent, of course, should be empirically adequate with respect to the physics. But what I want is to be minimal sufficiency, so there's no question about necessity in here, nothing about a priori. Of course, all this is fallible. So if someone comes up with a new fancy physical theory, and the theory is nothing like distances that he's talking about, etc., then this may be this will go and we'll have a new ontology. So I can put the question I would like to answer also in these terms. What is a minimal set of entities that form a common ontological ground that can accommodate the whole of physics in the sense of the whole of known established physics? And the idea behind that then is that ontology should not be theory dependent. So of course the theories are representations of the world, and we need the theories to get to the world, but the ontology should not change whenever you switch from one theory to another theory. The ontology should somehow be able to cover the theories you want to cover. Here's Feynman, just to warm up, what he said. So, Feynman, at the beginning of the Feynman lecture, said, if in some cataclysm all of scientific knowledge were to be destroyed, and only one sentence is passed on to the next generations of creatures, what statement would contain the most information in the fewest possible words? I believe it is the atomic hypothesis that all things are made of atoms, little particles that move around in perpetual motion, attracting each other when they are a little distance apart, but repelling upon being squeezed into one another. In that one sentence, you will see there's an enormous amount of information about the world, if just a little imagination and thinking are applied, okay? That's what we should try to do, apply a little imagination and thinking and how you get all the world out of this one sentence that you have atoms, little particles, and we see what are these atoms, claim they are only the entities, they are only the relata of certain basic relations, and this gives you everything as regards the physical world, okay? So I use an armchair traditional philosophical criteria. So if you look into, Frank Jackson has a paper, Armchair Metaphysics, and then he advocates conceptual analysis, etc. So if you read Jackson, Jackson will recommend that you do with as meager a diet as possible, so you use parsimony as a criterion for your ontology. Why? Because whenever you subscribe to an ontological commitment to something, that something will come from science, from your intuitions, from common sense, from religion or whatever your source is, you need an argument why people should subscribe to a commitment to this. So it's simple fact, the mere fact that something figures in the physical theory, in the mathematical structure of a physical theory, is to my mind not a sufficient reason. This is a reason to take it as a candidate for ontology, but it would not settle the question of ontology. Because the mathematical structure of physical theories is there to represent the world, for it's rather on the side of representation than on the side of ontology. So for ontology, then you need further, you need genuine philosophical criteria. In this sense, I'm a traditional metaphysician and thinks that ontology has to be settled by philosophical argument. Of course, philosophical argument is informed by science, and the scientists and the science will do the work for us, okay? And to put it differently,
if you think that you'd put more into the ontology than just what is minimally sufficient to give you empirical adequacy, you won't get deeper explanations. You'll just get trouble. Just get into trouble. So try to avoid trouble as much as possible, and then the best argument for endorsing an ontological commitment is you need it. You need it in a theory that is to be minimally sufficient. And there may be several candidates for what is minimally sufficient. As I said, it's not about necessity, but minimal sufficiency. But that's then a very good argument. It's, when you look into the world, that's what you need. So the first thing you need are relations, right? Relations are indispensable because you somehow want to cover the world. You want to have a world. So you need some relations. The relations relate objects. These objects better be simple to avoid further complications, but there are the relations. So Jonathan is here somewhere, right? And I think we talked about this, we met last time. So I think I can agree with you to a large extent. So if you want to be a priority monist, if you think that there's ontological priority of the whole universe, fine. But nevertheless, you need some differentiation because the universe is not just one there is differentiation there. So you need relations within the universe that carry out that differentiation. And if you need relations anyway, then you can employ them, you can do something with them, you can employ them to individuate simple objects. This, of course, is the idea behind structural realism. And then you get thin objects. That's the term Stephen Frankish used in a paper around 2010. Thin objects. The objects are thin in the sense that there's nothing more to them than standing in the relations that individuate them. So they don't have any intrinsic essences. I'm sorry, Anna, all this goes against the Aristotelian metaphysics, including neo-Aristotelian metaphysics. There are no intrinsic essences of things. And I think even unintelligible positions like the one of John Heyer, and I'm sorry to say Jonathan Lowy, that you don't have relations. I don't see how you can do without some basic relations that unify the world. And what relations? Well, we're talking about the natural world, so the first guess is to use spatial relations. Cartesian, Descartes. When Descartes criticized scholastic philosophy, he threw out all these internal forms, all these qualities, etc. But he kept extension. And to get to the natural world, we'll see in second argument later, but one argument is, well, the first guess is that you need some relations that provide for extension. Distances do the job. Distance relations. Distance relations are irreflexive, symmetric. They are connected in the sense that every two objects in the configuration are connected by them. And the only metrical requirement I would like to impose is that they fulfill the triangle inequality, but distances don't have to be Euclidean, they don't have to be three-dimensional or four-dimensional. This all comes up later. This also, the geometry is then an issue of what representation is best to capture the world, but the relations as such, they don't have to fulfill certain geometrical criteria, so again, it's just minimal spatiality requirement. So you look, you need some relations. You cannot just stay in the abstract level and say, okay, there have to be some relations or other. You have to put in some candidate because you want to end up with the natural. So for instance, if you put in thinking, assume that just for the sake of the argument that Descartes is right, then you would have thinking relations among mind points, and thinking relations would individuate minds. Now that's not what you want when you talk about the natural world. Perhaps there are Cartesian minds. Another issue, but you need some specific relations. So you cannot just stay in the abstract level and say there are relations in the ontology and the individual objects without naming a candidate for the relations. And of course, when you name a candidate, it may go wrong, but that's business. Okay? So that's all minimal. That's all, I would say, not like I see you may dispute everything, but not so much. There comes a drawback. I want the relations to individuate simple objects, so that I avoid to have to accept a numerical plurality of objects as a primitive.
That's why I can cite Jonathan, at least I hope I can cite
with you, because the objects are not put in from the outset. There's not as primitive a certain number of objects, but you get them from the relations. And then what is known as weak discernibility would not be sufficient. You need the absolute discernibility. You need absolute discernibility to distinguish the objects, because otherwise they would not be ordered
so back to science. I think some 10 years ago, but this distinction between weak and absolute discernibility, and then there is a discussion, and there was a very good objection from Chris, I think 2009, that weak comes to it, that weak discernibility will do the work. This was about spatial relations at the time. So I'm happy now to say, yes, we have to go for absolute discernibility, we have to pay the price, but the reward is that we avoid having to accept a numerical plurality of objects as a primitive. We then get objects individuated by relations, but we have to exclude anti-symmetrical ones. Okay, so this is why the original title I gave there was Leibnizian relationalism. So Leibniz, of course, defended the strong words of the principle of the identity of indiscernible. So for Leibniz, the things were absolutely discernible, they were really distinct. So entirely symmetrical worlds are excluded, although those physical theories admit solutions, admit absolute symmetrical worlds as models. And then you have to say for philosophical arguments, sorry, this is mathematical surplus, this does not describe the real world. So to put this point differently, there's a certain tension in quantum structural realism. You have on the one hand, like Stephen Friend and others, laying stress on symmetries. Symmetries are to be the guide to the ontic structures, to the structures that end the world. And you want the structures to individuate objects, and so far as there are objects at all in the ontology. This is another old debate between moderate and radical versions of structural realism, but it's not relevant here. You need some objects, and if you get these objects individuated by the relations, I think they are unobjectionable objects, so to speak. Okay? So you want your structures to do both, but they can't do both. Because the more symmetrical your structures are, the less they are able to individuate objects. So again, clear choices are the best choices. Pro, no, abandon one, abandon the symmetries as the guide to the ontology. Symmetries are good for representation. They give you a great improvement in simplicity. They make your representations much more simple without using much information. So the real world, of course, is not symmetrical. Will never be symmetrical. We are here. But conceiving of it as if it were symmetrical is for certain purposes, cosmology, very good. You simplify without losing too much information. Okay? So these just these flags, of course, any ontological position comes with a price. The question is whether it's worth paying the price. This is worth paying. So there we are with Leibniz relations. So we have distance relations, they make up a configuration of what coexists, to paraphrase Leibniz, they make up the order of what coexists. We have time that then derives from change because of the second axiom there that says that there's change. So time derives from that second axiom about change. So you have change as a primitive. You can get time as the order of succession from change. I think that there is some direction built in to change without there being a temporal notion, because change goes from one configuration to another, but there's no direction in the distances. So here you have a configuration, and what we have there, yes, then this changes goes on there and there, and the change goes from here to here, so you can have an order there, a unit order, a directed order, without having to presuppose some time. Okay? So now let's do a second step. Let's give a bit meat to this picture, how it could accommodate physics. And I want to draw or advocate
drawing a distinction within the physical theory between a primitive ontology and the dynamical structure. So the primitive ontology of a given theory are those entities that exist simply in the world according to the theory, whatever these entities may be. So I steal here a notion from another context. This came up in the discussion about how to solve the measurement problem in quantum theory, and something claim there in Morton and Unscale, you need a primitive ontology in the sense of entities that are localized in three-dimensional or four-dimensional space, and Bell called these entities local vehicles. So they are not observables, they exist, they are vehicles, and they are local. But I'm after here, it's a wider notion of a primitive ontology. There's nothing built in here that these things have to be localized in three or four-dimensional space. You can be committed to that space, and primitive ontology, etc. Whatever it may be, it can also be wave functions, for that matter. I think the view of a wave function simply existing in the world. Perhaps that's not the issue here now. So a primitive ontology just needs a distinction between something that fills in the place of what simply exists and something which comes in as, which comes in through a function of the behavior or the evolution of what simply exists. Okay? So you have some entities, you need something that simply is there, and then you have something in your theory that tells you how what there is simply evolved. Then you can make a further step and say now, as I said before, I don't like the notion of ontology being relative to the theory. Theory, of course, is vital to the ontology, but the ontology is about what there is, full stop. So for a primitive ontology to cure, so what are the entities, we come back to the question first, like what are the entities that simply exist in the world, given our best physical view? And again, there's quite straightforward way to single out relative positions, because all the evidence that we have, all the experimental evidence that we have in physics, is evidence of discrete objects, the change of position of these discrete objects. So even if you consider, say, double slit experiment in quantum mechanics, you don't have any evidence of a wave particle duality or anything like that. You just have particle evidence. You just have dots on a screen. If you can run the experiment by putting in one particle at a time, or every Monday after lunch, you put in one particle, so every Monday after lunch you get off one dot. You do this a long time, you get a certain pattern of dots, and you may wish to explain that patterns in terms of a wave, but you don't see a wave. When you test a field, you always see particle motion. You test the field by means of a particle. Also in quantum field theory, the evidence that you get is particle evidence. So this suggests that there is distinction of position is distinguished. So you get another, then you can hear your own, you get the appearances thrown out. So you want the primitive ontology to cool. What's the best guess you can make? The best guess you can make about what simply exists in the world? Well, it should be, it doesn't have to be local beavers in that narrow sense. I don't know whether free, I mean, at this stage I don't want to commit myself whether there's a three-dimensional space or a four-dimensional space term or something like that. But there are discrete objects, and discrete objects stand in distance relations. These distance relations individuate them, and that's how I get my theory started. And if I do this, I have a link automatically built in. That's what is good about this notion of locality. It's a link with the evidence, because the evidence comes down to that. Okay? So we have this distinction between a primitive ontology and a dynamical structure. Let's work with this distinction for the sake of the next 20 minutes or so. And now we see that there's one thing to have a primitive ontology that is simple in the sense of parsimonious, and to have a dynamical structure that is simple in the sense of being simple for matters of representation. And these two senses are not the same. They're opposed to each other. If you go back here, if that is all the information I give you, the positions, the relative positions of these objects and how they evolve over time, if I just give you how they change, if I just give you such a configuration in terms of relative distances and nothing else, you have no idea. I've not given you any information about how this changed. I've not given any information about the laws for the change. Now, it may be possible to come up with some description by just using relative positions, but you would never come up with a simple law like Newtonian gravitation or a quantum law of motion for objects. So you need more. You need more for representation, right? You need further parameters. That's how masses, wave functions, fields, geometry, energy, etc. comes in now. And I want to resist saying that, okay, if all these other things, all these other parameters come in, so just enrich your ontology. They are all there. It would not get us very far, because it would get us into additional problems. I'll come to that later. It will inflate our ontology. It would make our ontology change whenever the dynamics change. Perhaps you would get different ontologies for the same theories. You would get, say, different ontologies for Hamiltonian classical mechanics or whatever. So the idea now is to say, if you are using simplicity in the sense of parsimony as the guide to ontology, we stop at the primitive ontology. We don't go beyond primitive ontology with our ontological commitments. So we refuse to take the use and have to use and metaphysicians such as Jackson as my guide to ontology, and then say no, better use Jackson on parsimony than the mathematical structure of your theory as the guide to ontology, because the structure is after simplicity and representation to achieve that it needs much more than there has to be in the world. So now comes in unionism. But unionism comes in, I have no a priori intrinsic being a continental philosopher, I mean from geographical, continental philosopher, from particular inclinations to humor. So I just serve. I'm skeptical about going on further with my ontological commitments. Now I need some horse to run this through. And Hume just is this horse. So I'm not concerned about the metaphysics of modality here, so whether there are necessary connections or not like this. I need some argument, I need some fleshing out of the idea that you can be a scientific realist, accept the physical theories as they are, accept their dynamical structure, without subscribing to an ontological commitment to all what there is in the mathematics of a physical theory. And that's what unionism provides. And you can even do more with this. That's how the name superunionism comes up now, because you'll be more union than David Lewis, who is the exemplary union in contemporary metaphysics. So the idea is that your primitive ontology, the matter points individuated by distance relations and their change, is the union mosaic, the supervenience basis for everything. Everything else reduces to that. So you don't have any properties in there. There are simply no properties. If you don't have any properties, you don't have to go into the controversy between categorical and dispositional properties. So you don't have any categorical properties, so you don't get into the stock objections of quiddityism and humility. There's nothing which has intrinsic qualitative essence. There's nothing like worlds in which you can swap masses and charges because they are quiddities and they one of the same property plays the mass role in one world and the charge for another world. All this mathematical things goes to the waste basket. So if you don't have these objections, this is welcome. You do have natural relations. So there are no natural properties, but natural relations. Distances are the only natural relations. You need natural relations to avoid arbitrariness. Supervenient space should not be arbitrary. That would, of course, Lewis needs natural properties to get his union distance going, but then relations can do this. Okay? And now you treat the geometry and the dynamical parameters in the same way as laws. They are not nomological. Some people say wave function things like that, and nomological can cause misunderstandings. Of course, they are not laws. The idea, for my mind, is they have the same status as the laws. They supervene. They come in through the role that they play in the laws. You want now, the only information that you have is the information about, yes, you have this,
yeah, take away the chairs and keep the people in this room, right? Then I can use the chairs as my geometry to describe how the people are positioned, because what matters are your relative position. Now, your relative positions evolve over time, they change, there's no time in ontology to change, right? There are certain patterns in that change, and now I want to find a law, right? So the law is quite easy. So usually people are distributed in lecture rooms so that they don't sit in the front, they are concentrated somewhere in the back, but not at the right in the corners, etc. So there's a certain pattern of the behavior of people when they go into lecture rooms,
right? So now I want to have a law. So to have a law, I need more parameters now than just where people are and how the configuration of people in lecture rooms changes. Attribute them a mass to them. That may help. So you may help describing how you have a center here and people attract towards the center in the room, etc. Okay? So all the geometry, all the dynamics, they're treated in the same way as the laws, in the sense that they come in as a package. They come in as whatever may be the best package that gives you, as output, a system that strikes the best balance between being simple and being informative. And this has been done for many physical theories. So Nat Hall, unfortunately only in an unpublished paper, as far as I know, a published version in some volume that's Oxford University Press is too short. That so Nat Hall has the idea that the union can accommodate the dispositionalist intuition that properties are tied to the role that they play by saying that the properties such as mass and charge in classical mechanics, they are law-like, they come in through the law, and the law comes in as supervening on, in the usual Humean way, as supervening on the patterns and the particle motion. So you cannot have worlds in which there's mass, but the objects don't attract each other, because mass is tied to attraction. But this does not apply to subscribe to an ontological commitment to dispositions out there in the world. You can get all this by conceiving the mass and the charge as being tied to the laws in the sense that they come in as the package, as the Humean package, which gives you the best balance between simplicity and information about the description of the particle motion. Okay? So the propositions that describe mass as separate from particles are, of course, true. It's a scientific realist position. But what is their truth maker is not a mass sitting in the objects, but it is the way it's like Hume or Humeanism about causation. So what makes these statements true is the overall behavior of the particles, and the behavior is the way in which they move, the way in which they change their position. Again, you have to divide the world, that I think it's in fact it's nicely deserved. The consequence is that there are no intrinsic particle species. So there's no intrinsic distinction between, say, electrons and protons and neutrons. Some particles move electron-wise, so to speak, other proton-wise, etc. And it's from the patterns of their motion that you then simplify the description, attach the label electrons to some particles. But this is not instrument, it is because it's true to say that they are electrons. But the truth maker for that is the way in which they move, and not the other way around. It's the same, again, it's objection, armchair metaphysics behind this idea, in the sense that you have something within your ontology that is simply there, and all the rest comes in by implication. So, all the rest is true, of course, but it does not enrich your ontology. Once you have settled your basic ontology, you have two slang for all the true propositions, and then of course these propositions are true without them being literally speaking objects that are intrinsically electrons. Okay, you can do the same with space and time. Nick Hackett has a nice paper about how the geometry of absolute space, inertia, motion, acceleration, all this comes in as part of the union best system account for classical mechanics. So that relationalism, Leibnizian relationalism, then that's the message of Hackett. A Leibnizian relationalism does not commit herself to develop an alternative physical theory to Newtonian mechanics. There may be other independent reasons. So for instance, Julian Barber pursues a program of shape dynamics, which is an alternative theory not only to classical mechanics, but also to general relativity, for quantum gravity, etc. So there may be very good reasons to pursue such a program, because you think this will give you a unified physical theory, etc. But the simple fact that your ontology is limited to Leibnizian relations does not commit you to developing an alternative theory to Newtonian mechanics. Any such alternative theory would in any case need more than what there is in the sparse ontology of matter point individuated by distances. So shape dynamics needs a shape, so it's simple, needs more geometrical facts than just distances between particles. Now the same you could do in principle about relativity. I say in principle because I cannot cash out everything here. But again, it's the fact that the evidence also in general relativity, also when it comes to purely gravitational phenomena, you test it, it's particle motion. So Einstein at Infinite 1949, they say the gravitational field manifests itself in the motion of bodies. Therefore, the problem of determining the motion of such bodies, that's the issue, determine the motion of such bodies from the field equations alone is of fundamental importance. So you can have the idea, Antonio Borsello pursued this idea, we pursued this in the paper, that the curved geometry of GR is just the same as what Hubbard does for Newtonian mechanics, is there to represent the evolution of distances. You have a fundamental particle description, you coarse grain into an effective field description, and you don't go for fundamental spatial-temporal relations because this would commit you to more geometry. So the fundamental relations are distances. There may be distances and we represent them in 3, 4, 5, x dimensional geometry, but there's no temporal, there's no primitive temporal mathematical requirement built. You may have motivations to go for such a primitive temporal mathematical requirement, but then I would say change buys you more when it comes to all these problems, how to fit change into a blocked universe, etc. Just accept change. You can do it. Also, you can also pursue a Barber-type program for general relativity, etc. So I think when you start with this primitive ontology, it's an open issue how your best system works. Your best system may work with the dynamics of instantaneous interaction, as it does on Newtonian mechanics and some or most or all primitive ontology versions of quantum mechanics, the instantaneous interaction between the object and the bit. But you may also turn out that the dynamics, the best dynamics that fit best your mosaic, is one in which is a relativistic dynamic in which you have retarded interaction and possibly also advanced interaction. I'm open-minded on that, quite relaxed, because I don't think that anything deep for the ontology depends on that. Okay? So just make the point, whatever the dynamical structure may be, this then is an open issue. The same with fields. So it's a bad idea to think that you have to admit fields as stuff over and above particles. You need the particles for the evidence anyway. And the fields are in part of the dynamical structure. Bother about whether they are fields and whether they are properties of space-time points. You would be committed to absolute space-time with quite peculiar properties. So we had much to discussion with Justin Lazarovich, postdoc now, and has done a very nice paper on all these issues. So if you think them of space-time properties, they influence only the motion of some particles. If you think them of some sort of stuff, you have to primitive degrees of density of stuff, you may have regions where there's a zero field. Well, you get into all troubles, right? You get into all sorts of trouble. And so better put the fields not in the ontology, but into the dynamical structure. Then you don't have all these troubles. they're a good means to represent particle motion, but there's no need to be committed to them in the ontology, not in quantum mechanics either. Now you have the wave function as field parameter, okay? Wave function performs for quantum mechanics exactly the same job as classical fields do for classical motion of classical particles. But unfortunately, the wave function is a field on configuration space. It does not, you cannot think of it as some sort of stuff or property, whatever, that fills three-dimensional space or four-dimensional space-time. So how on earth could a wave function in another space influence the objects in ordinary space? You can say, okay, then there only is the configuration space. That would be one way to go. Or you can say the wave function is just a parameter in the best system. I mean, I think the idea originates in Craig's so you'll talk about this. So just flag the issue and say, that's one way you can go. And you're not an instrumentalist about the wave function. The same as this parameters like mass, charge, fields, etc. The wave function has a nomology. It's not nomological in the sense that it's a law, but it has a nomological function. It appears. It's a parameter introduced in the law of motion. And only then, afterwards, comes the fact, the fortunate fact, that you can deduce from the law of motion an algorithm that allows you to calculate probabilities for measurement. But the function of the wave function is not to be an instrument to calculate probabilities for measurement. The function of the wave function is to be the figure in the law, to be part of the best system. So the statements about wave functions, they are literally true. And but they are not made true by somehow being wave functions. They work in the same sense as any statements of something that superwings and union music are made true of unions. Okay? So unions, superunions, whatever else there may be to it, Louise's union, superunions, purged of these natural intrinsic properties, etc., can be literally true in quantum mechanics. There's no reason to admit entanglement as an additional natural relation. Don't get to the problem. It represents possible evolutions of distances between your primitive objects. So, and then you can put in, of course, to illustrate all this, and most people who are involved in this business use Bohmian mechanics with particle positions as the primitive ontology as the illustration of this proposal, and all this, of course, fits nicely with the proposal for primitive ontology only in terms of matter points and individual distances. That the argument for going Bohmian here, again, I can only flag the issue, is that it provides the best solution to measurement problem. So the argument, of course, is independent, otherwise no business would be circular. In quantum mechanics, you have in any case the measurement problem. So when you talk about the ontology of quantum mechanics, you have to say, you have to, in German would say, follow the mechanic. You have to say where you stand, right? In any case, with respect to the measurement. Now, there are reasons, there's a separate discussion to say the Bohmian theory provides the best solution. Of course, all those who have apparatic inclinations won't agree with that, but that's then another issue to debate. Okay, so there are arguments to say this provides the best solution. And when you have this, then you can run further the primitive ontology story. In any case, the wave function is then part of the dynamical structure. So the message is, how is it called? Bohmianism?
That's a horrible word. Yeah.
So in English, it's that.
Elizabeth came up with it, I think.
Yeah, okay, so you kind of Bohmian use. So the message is because people usually represent Bohmian mechanics, they are particles and they represent their wave functions. They are just particles. This then goes through. It gives you the best solution to the measurement problem, it gives you the best component, right? And you can do the same with quantum field theory. So you can do the same. I'm running out of time now. See you already, so don't go into this. You can do the same, just this is the paper of Dirk Deckard and myself, with this forthcoming, so it's forthcoming BJPS, so it's somewhere in there. Just believe me that you can do exactly the same as Bohmian mechanics does for quantum mechanics, also for quantum field theory. The argument again is that you get the best solution to measure the problem. Now, I'm not scared of quantum gravity, okay? So if time emergence of, so there are these claims, of course the objection comes up, what about quantum gravity? I don't know what about gravity. That if the issue is that there's no time, as some people say, if time is how I emerge, yes, we know this. This is well studied since Leibniz. Time can emerge from change. Okay. If there's emergence of space, then I get somehow lost, and then I don't know what physical theory we are talking about. Physical theory that includes matter and the quantization of space time. Then I know. Then I look into Wawa, then I see shape dynamics may work, quantum gravity, Shelley Goldstein things, the Bohmian primitive ontology may work, etc. And then I tend to think, as things stand, I mean, all this is fabulated. As things stand, I don't think that there is a threat from quantum gravity that we have to change the fundamental ontology. The lesson in all these cases from quantum physics is that it's a non-starter to try to deduce ontology from operators. So you hear some people say or thought that there are no particle trajectories in quantum mechanics because of the Heisenberg in quantum explanations. Some people think that there are no permanent particles in quantum field theory because of appearances, particle creation, annihilation, operators, appearances, and disappearances of particles. But these are fallacies because the standard for ontology in quantum physics is not really the ontology of from operators, but to come up with a solution to the measurement of it. And then it may turn out that good, at least it is a fact that a serious candidate for a solution to the measurement problem has particles, even permanent particles in its ontology, and trajectories for these particles. And it's not wrong because there are isolated in certain derivations of Fock-space operators. Particle creation and annihilation. It may be wrong because it does not give you the best solution to the measurement problem, but that's another discussion. So the standard for ontology is a solution to the measurement problem. And now, as stands with respect to quantum gravity, there are not even measurement predictions, so no solution to the measurement problem. So if someone thinks that all this is wrong, or to learn, or to hear what they say about the measurement problem. Okay? So, very quickly, the argument, now back to philosophy, why should you not enrich the ontology? Because it does not buy you anything. That's why I moved away from this position. Sorry, Mauro, we had done a lot of work on these positions, but now I'm more skeptical. Just because of the old old Molière objection, it does not give you explanation. So if you are committed to absolute space, is this Tim Morgan? Tim thinks then he can explain constraints on the distance relation such as the triangle inequality. But of course, to be entitled to such explanations, the absolute space has to satisfy or at least to support some symmetrical constraints from which you derived it. So you just go one step back, but that's no gain in explanation. So instead of having primitive distance relations, you have a primitive absolute space, and this gives you only surplus structure. Same if you say you're committed to masses, forces, fields, etc., in order to answer the question why the particles move in the way in which they do, in fact. So you won't get a metaphysical explanation of particle motion on a Humean view, of course. This is just what there is. And there may be a metaphysical explanation, but we don't get it through our physical theories, because there you just go circular again. Why do people fall asleep after the consumption of opium, coffee, or having pasta for lunch, etc. Well, because pasta has a dawn virtue, opium has a dawn virtue, no explanation. Why do objects attract each other? Because they have masses. Well, is the mass or what mass, whatever makes objects attract each other? No explanation. Why are the outcomes of the PR experiments correlated? Because the particles are entangled. What is it that they entangle? The entanglement is whatever makes that they manifest correlated motion under certain circumstances. So you just get circular explanations and artificial problems. So if you have a Newtonian particle here with its intrinsic mass, how does that mass go to the other end of space and attract the particle there? If you put in fields, it will be hard for that question, etc. How does a wave function influence the motion of matter? So if you enrich your ontology, you only get into trouble. Okay? So to conclude, the issue is what is the best candidate for a primitive ontology in the sense of what simply exists in the world? Best proposal on the table since Democritus, it's point particles individuated by spatial relations, the change of these relations. That gives you everything, and notably it gives you a robust scientific realism, because you don't have to change your ontology whenever you make physical progress in representing the dynamics of your object, so you're less hit by the arguments from pessimistic meta-induction, underdetermination, etc. It gives you also a definition of what physicalism can be. Then physicalism then is the claim that everything that exists reduces to patterns in this particle motion. That's a robust physicalism. It may be false, it is not trivial, etc., but it does not change whenever physics changes, etc. It makes also the limits of science clear. So, for instance, people write papers, and Chris and I, our Geneva colleague Nicolas Gisin, who's a very good physicist, for instance, is concerned about determinants and things that you should go for GNW change theory, because theory is indeterministic, and that's a bad argument for GNW. I mean, they made good arguments for GNW. But you want, of course, a deterministic physical theory, because it's simply the most formative theory if it is deterministic. And it's just business of physics. And now you may think that you have free will, you may have good reasons to think you have free will, undoubtedly you have free will, but the fact that physical theories better be deterministic does not infringe upon your free will. It's completely unconnected. So this makes it clear, the physics, the physical representation is there to give you as simple and as formative as possible a representation of the evolution of the objects that you have in your ontology. And this is metaphysically neutral. If you charge this now with heavy metaphysics in the sense that you think that there are wave functions around here that literally push your things or other modal entities, then you may get into trouble, but not on the physics as such. So there are virtues beyond the philosophy of physics for this account. I claim, namely, to give you a good notion of scientific realism, of physicalism, and to make clear that you don't need sleepless nights if you think that you're a free person, you can be a free person, and your emotion can even influence or contribute to determine what the laws of the universe are, not the other way around. So this gives you everything, right? So if you just put bread and water in the ontology, you get out everything you want, and all this is true then, that law, stillness, etc. exist or should exist. You can even deduce the normative statements, so you get all the ingredients to enjoy your life. Thank you.